And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode number 49.
An extreme episode.
Extreme. So extreme, it's got triple X, X, X. Adam Gerke here, Sarah Michelle Fetters, Tim Hall, all making the rounds here.
And, good to be back.
Yeah, Tim, good to have you in here. We have got a lot to dig into between two films from last week, three films from this week. We've got a few discussions we're going to have amongst ourselves here a little bit later on in the show.
Although, if we're being technical, technically three films from last year that just seem to open Seattle now.
Yeah, why not? So, that being the case, let's just jump right on into this. We're talking Live by Night, and we're talking Prohibition era. So, thinking 20s, 30s, specifically 30s. It's the time of mobsters and speakeasies, time of small-time criminals. Joe Coughlin, played by Ben Affleck, he's kind of got an axe to grind with an Irish mob boss that is played by Robert Glenister, and the guy's name is Albert White, but he's exacting his revenge. He wants to, basically, Affleck's character wants to exact his revenge, but to do that, he's got to go to Florida, working for a mafia don. And he takes over, basically, the rum-making business, takes on the KKK, the local police, and then still left with a giant hole in his heart. Does it ever get better? I don't know. I mean, that's kind of where Live by Night comes in. Is any of this sounding maybe like a retread of any other mob film from Prohibition eras that we've seen over the last 100 years?
Well, yes.
Probably a lot of them, but I mean, it is based on, it is Ben Affleck going back to Dennis Lehane territory, the author who also wrote his directorial debut, Gone Baby Gone.
Right.
And the book is really complex and has a ton of layers and has ample opportunity to dive into the many nuances that this story wants to travel in, which is, you know, you got the Italian mob, you've got the Irish mob, you've got the police corruption in Boston, you've got Cuban immigrants in Florida,
all these layers.
It's all there, and the book does a great job of showcasing that.
Now,
the movie has some trouble.
And why do you suppose that is? I mean, there's a writer, director, actor who seems to take the lead on all of this. That would be one Ben Affleck,
who has succeeded in the past with this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not as big on The Town as a lot of other people are, but if you look at Gone Baby Gone and Argo, he has been able to juggle a lot of this stuff better in his previous films.
Sure.
Part of me thinks, and there's no way to really know this because the studio's never going to admit it, Affleck's never going to admit it, part of me thinks that Warner Brothers and Affleck were so intent on getting this into theaters in time to qualify for the Oscars that they just didn't give him enough opportunity to sit in the editing room and really figure out how everything was supposed to fit together. You have to remember, as he finished this film, he went right into acting in Justice League.
Yep.
So he went...
acting in quotes.
Acting.
No, he... the general consensus is he's the best thing about Batman versus Superman. I'm just saying general consensus doesn't necessarily mean between us.
Aquaman might be the best thing about Batman v Superman.
Well, he's only in it for like a second and a half.
I still think he may be the best thing in
there. You go. But I mean, just from a time perspective, he went right from that movie, from Batman v Superman, into Live by Night, and then right into another film.
Yeah.
I think Warner Brothers and Affleck would have been far better off had they looked one another in the eye and said, you know what, finish with this, finish Justice League, and then take another 6-7 months to put this film together. Because I think there is a good film in here. There's an amazing cast.
Yeah.
And everybody in it is trying to really give some outstanding performance. I mean, Chris Cooper and Elle Fanning in particular have some sensational moments. But their characters are never developed well enough that those moments mean anything.
Yeah.
And I do think that there's a potentially really good film lurking inside of here if he would have just spent more time working with it.
Yeah. Tim, did you get a chance to catch up with this?
I did see it, unfortunately. Yeah. I just don't think there's enough to care about any of the characters in the film.
Right.
Yeah. There's just so much going on. He's trying to build a casino. He somehow teams up with the Cubans without any pushback. He's like, we're gonna do the rum business together. And they're like, sure. Yeah. Miguel's in it for some strange reason for like 2 seconds. There's just too much going on, way too many storylines, not enough depth. Yeah. Not enough, especially so at the end of the film, you're supposed to care about these things, and I don't care.
Mm-hmm. What's like his relationship with Zoe Saldana, speaking about the Cuban connection. They set up Zoe Saldana to be a really fascinating character, this woman that...
The do-gooder slash walking the line of, you know, organized crime.
Exactly. And she's really fascinating initially. And they, of course, fall into a tumultuous, passionate love affair, which, again, is potentially very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then the movie just kind of drops it, and she just becomes the woman by his side, which is so unfortunate, because what a great character that the movie just doesn't know what to do with.
Yeah. Cinematography, I thought, was actually pretty sharp.
That's the thing. It's really sharp cinematography when you watch it.
It looks good.
Oh, the production design is amazing.
Yeah.
The cinematography is outstanding.
Yeah.
I think the costuming. Yeah. I mean, and Affleck still can. I mean, he stages some superb moments. I mean,
except for that shootout at the end. That was kind of.
I think the shootout. I actually think the shootout at the end is outstanding. I think there's some editing issues with the shootout.
Stood out to me.
Really? See, I would completely disagree. I think the shootout at the end's great, but even better to me is sort of the Model T car chase that happens earlier on in the film, which just has, it's just vibrating in electricity and energy, and it's just really fun to watch.
Yeah.
And the movie can just never build off any of that.
Yeah.
There are a couple.
But let's just wrap this one, bring this count to the barn. Theater rent skips are on, yes?
You know, after I watched it in December, I was going to say Rent, but when I actually had to, because we had to hold our reviews here in Seattle until January, when I wrote my review, it kind of became a skip. So I'm going to actually go with the full-on skip.
Okay.
Skip.
And Tim's going skip as well.
Skip.
All right. Well, I was actually going to be a little softer on it and giving it that rental factor out of the fact that I think for the cinematography and for the art direction in there, there are some great things.
Some performances again.
I think in a former life, I was living in the 30s, so I love seeing the cars and the fashion and all that. So
love
for me,
it's
always like, oh, it's home again. So there's that to it. How about what's going on with Patriots Day? Tim, tell us a little bit about
Day
Patriots Day.
Is based on a 2013 tragic Boston bombing.
Right. So this just happened.
It just happened.
It's like our Boston, it's like our Boston double feature.
Yeah, right. It's directed by Peter Berg, stars Mark Wahlberg, Michelle Monaghan, J.K. Simmons, John Goodman's in it.
Kevin Bacon's in it a little bit.
Yeah.
Everybody's in this movie.
And it sort of follows the events afterwards. It's really centered around Mark Wahlberg's character, who plays a Boston PD officer. And I can see what Peter Berg was trying to do, which was have all these different stories and see how they intersect around this major event over the 4 days from the bombing to, you know, the Sarnoff brothers are captured. And that's kind of the film. Mm-hmm. But I don't think as a full piece of film it works.
Hmm.
I think individual vignettes it's okay, but as a film it didn't really click.
Click for you.
It's interesting. You know, Wahlberg and Berg, now they sort of have their true life trilogy now.
Right.
They've got this
Deepwater Horizon.
Deepwater Horizon and Lone Survivor.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's sort of become their America, go America triple feature.
And the timing between Deepwater Horizon and this is like months apart.
Oh, yeah, I have no idea how they managed to do that, to be honest. I mean, it's especially as technologically complex as Deepwater Horizon was, to then jump into this one right away, which isn't as visually audacious, but still structurally just as complex with as many different characters as there are and all of the different subplots that are going on. I think I liked it a little bit more than you did, Tim. I think the movie, as a stripped down Law and Order-ish procedural, works rather well. I think a lot of the moments looking at the intricacies of the actual chase for the Tsarnaevs is interesting. I think the movie lets down its female characters quite a bit. I also think it doesn't know what to do with the Tsarnaevs. On one hand, it treats them as larger than life, horrific, monstrous cartoons. But on the other hand, there are moments where it tries to actually get inside their head, and it can't walk that line. You've got to at some point make a decision: is are you going to treat these two individuals who did this heinous, horrific act? Are you going to treat them as human beings, or are you going to just treat them as monsters?
I think that's because they don't know what kind of movie they're making.
Exactly,
it's not really a manhunt movie. It's not really about the city of Boston. Yeah. It's not really about the survivors. It's not about the people who lost their lives. It's not really about the PD. It's kind of a bunch of different things at the same time, which is fine. But I think the thing that really struck me was at the end, there's some actual real life footage. And to me, that was way more compelling than the movie.
But that's, but I mean, that's without all three of...
Without all, none of the melodrama nonsense. Like when that, the one of the guys who lost his legs, when he's running around and he says, this is the toughest part of the race, because like, I'm running past where the bombing happened. Yeah. And he hugs his wife and he's crying. Way more compelling. And that was literally like 30 seconds of actual footage.
But right. I mean, that's sort of become the Berg Wahlberg trademark now, right? I mean, Deepwater Horizon had the sort of 5-minute mini documentary at the very end talking about the real people. Lone Survivor had sort of the 5-minute mini documentary at the end talking to real people. I mean, it seems to be that they make these movies and then they got to have that thing at the end where they actually go and look at the real people and
did,
say,
hey. Did you see Pedro's?
I did see it.
And here they are.
Here, you know, kind of the thing that stood out to me was that there is, in real life, there was no Mark Wahlberg character. He's an amalgamation of several officers. And I get why they create his character to be the sort of the golden thread that helps tie the whole thing together.
Yeah.
I had a kind of issue with that where it just feels like,
I agree.
Man, how do you get to be in the same place, in the right place, at the right time, every time? Now, albeit, I do appreciate the fact that they, other than his character, they managed to tell the events in chronological order and in a way that I pretty much remember them.
But they left out a lot. Though.
They did.
How they misidentify some people as the bombers,
right?
And how people use Reddit to help find to help find the photos, which was like a huge part of the story that's just not there.
And then there's another police officer that was killed, who was just not in the movie at all.
Yeah,
I mean, they bring up the MIT officer, and actually, I think that's a great little subplot in the movie showing the MIT officer, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology officer. I really love that little subplot with him where they show who he was and what it was going on in his life at that time and all that sort of stuff. And just the heroism of not allowing them to take his gun.
Yeah.
I mean, that simple act and what it cost him.
At all.
I thought that was great. But then why do you leave out the other officer that was killed too?
It's all meant to like pull at your heartstrings. I thought the more important story is how do we handle something that we label a terrorist event in a post 9/11 world.
And
how does FBI handle it? How does the media handle it?
That's a really poignant scene too, where Kevin Bacon's character says that.
Yes, it's very, because that's the more interesting thing, because it's so real, and I think the event is so close to now that we remember a lot of it.
Yeah.
Well, and to me, that's the more interesting thing. I mean, we can do the cartoonish manhunt stuff, or we can, you know, have a smarter film about what does it actually look like.
But
and those events are shaped differently now than they were 10 years ago.
But I think you're exactly right on this. Like, there's a scene in the film where Tsarnaev's wife, played by Supergirl, Melissa Benoist, she is interrogated by Candy Alexander. And it's this one scene inside this entire movie that is completely different than anything else in the movie that actually touches on a lot of the themes that Tim is talking about. And you're like, wait, why is this scene, which is so smart and so precise and so intelligent and so cutting and really just kind of, it is walking this line as what can we do? What should we do? What is right? What is wrong?
Interrogating somebody without reading their eyes, all that stuff.
It's a crazy scene. And also, both women are just fantastic in the scene. Yeah. And then there's nothing else like it at all, ever again, in the entire movie.
It's on the shelf. It is.
It's just like there, which was just a little odd.
Yeah. But even at the end when his friends get... You realize the people pinched, in the dorm. Yeah, they get pinched for, and that's kind of barely in the film.
I do think it's interesting that this is Berg trying to make his David Fincher movie to the point where he actually brings in Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross
doing the score.
To score it.
Yeah.
And you keep thinking to yourself, you know what? If David Fincher had made this movie, it would be like Zodiac and it would be a masterpiece. Yeah.
Right. And the humor to me didn't work. All the humor in the film felt off.
I didn't have as much problem with that.
Because they're like cracking jokes as like in the middle of them trying to get one of the brothers out of the boat.
Right. Although, I mean...
Oh, that boat, that's not gonna float
again.
Like, what are we doing?
There is, having worked in the news cycle long enough, there is a certain amount of gallows humor that we all seem to have.
Right.
From law enforcement to reporters. And you have to have it, otherwise you will just gouge your eyes out at the end of the day, because so much of what we see is so terrible and horrible that helps cut that edge. And so I kind of went, that kind of stuff happens.
And apparently some of that is... is based on interviews that they did with some of those officers at that time. And apparently there was a lot, let's just say a lot more...
a lot more language that was left on the cutting room floor.
We'll go there.
Yeah. So theater rent, Skip.
I think it's a solid rental. I mean, I think it's a good movie that never quite becomes great.
Yeah. Tim, how about you?
This is Skip.
A Skip for Tim.
Wow. Skip for me.
Wow. Okay. Well, okay. Sarah, and I'm going with you in the rental category. Simple as that. That brings us to actually, you know, 20th Century Women. This is one that's out this week. We actually, Sarah, I don't remember, were you in it at the screening with me?
Yeah, we saw this back in December,
this
early
December. This was a while ago, so I had to rack my brain to try and go, okay, what's going on here? Oh, yeah.
The big Oscar contender.
Exactly. So here's what's going on. We've got a story that's partially told through the eyes of a quickly growing teenage boy. His name's Jamie, and he's been tasked, or three women have been tasked to help raise Jamie to become sort of a complete and rounded person. And they're tasked by his mother, specifically Dorothea, who's played, in this case, by Annette Bening. But there are two other women of importance, Abby, Greta Gerwig, and also Julie L. Fanning, who happens to be sort of Jamie's, I guess, closest in age compatriot.
It's his crush.
Right, his crush.
It's his best friend, but also... You know,
So
that first girl you fall in love with.
Right. So Jamie's living life, trying to be raised. I guess he's not trying to be raised, but he's been asked to be raised by these women. They're learning from him. He's learning from them. Meanwhile, they're exploring their freedoms, their love, sexuality, Southern California. It's the 1970s. And that's kind of where this picks up and drops off. It's all written and directed by Mike Mills. And he's the one who also did Beginners a couple years back with Ewan McGregor.
Christopher Plummer. One Christopher Plummer is Oscar.
Now, and good point, you made mention of this earlier when we were off air on this, was that was Mills' adulthood or young adulthood. This is sort of his autobiographical young adulthood in many regards, the time he spent with mom. So
we should say again,
it's loosely based on events in his
life.
Right. So my initial impressions on this, story narrative doesn't really have much of an arc. In fact, it's relatively flat, but what it does do, and does a fantastic job at that, is it gives you a great window of time, or, you know, capturing a moment in this boy's life where there was magic and there was a lot of learning going on. I think that's ultimately what's going on here. Am I feeling you on that as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what's really great about this movie is that even though it is all seen through this young boy's eyes, it is a movie about these three women. It's more about them and who they are and what they are doing and what they are experiencing and what they are trying to do in their lives, more so than it is about him.
Yeah.
And that, in effect, helps him become a better man.
Yeah.
The mistakes they make, the successes they have, the problems that they're going through, all of this gives him insight in what it is to be an adult and to grow. And it's astonishingly even-handed. Even though, you know, Mike Mills is a male writer-director, he somehow just taps into these three women in a way that is just poignant and touching and just beautiful. And all three of them. I mean, Bening is extraordinary. Gerwig might be... I've loved her in a lot of films. I mean, you and I would argue about Frances Ha, but I mean, I think she's fabulous in that, but this might be the best she's ever been in anything. And Elle Fanning just continues in movie after movie after movie to make us just kind of sit back and go, wow. And I will also say Billy Crudup has a small role in this movie too, as sort of the lone adult male member that lives in the house that they're in. It's so nice to see him back and doing stuff, with this and Jackie. He's great in both films, and in this film it's almost like he's playing the adult version of his character from Almost Famous, like, you know, his rock star from that movie after he sort of became famous and then is no longer famous.
Yes.
Kind of feels like it's a continuation of that character, but now on the downside, but understanding what's happened in his life.
I really like what you're also saying in the writing that Mills has come up with here, that he's really crafted three-dimensional characters. That, to me, was what stood out the most from all of this. And I mean, they're walking, talking, they're flawed, they're complex, they're interesting, they're compelling. All of that all comes together in that. Tim, did you get a chance?
I did not.
Okay, no. This one's not. Okay, so this is our discussion right here. Okay.
Well, I love that you bring that, because Dorothea,
no,
she is a perfect mother because of her imperfections. It's because she has flaws and because she does make mistakes and because she doesn't know all the answers That's what makes her a great mother.
Yeah.
She embraces that, and she learns from those just as much as her son learns from what's going on in his life.
Yeah.
And the relationship that they end up having is so much more powerful because of that.
Yeah.
I do think the movie kind of meanders just a little bit.
Hmm.
I don't necessarily... There's a coda at the end that is cute but feels a little tacked on in a way.
Mm. This is what happened to so-and-so. Yeah, this is what happened to so-and-so.
It's cute. It's nice. But I don't know if it was necessary.
Yeah, take it or leave it.
I could have taken it or left it. The young actor who plays Jamie, Lucas Jade Zuman, I think he does a good job. Mm-hmm. I have to watch the movie again to say if I think he does a great job. There were moments where I felt like he just kind of vanished. And I don't mean vanished because he was observing. I just mean he just kind of vanished.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other moments where I think he's just priceless in the scene, especially a couple scenes that he shares with Fanning when they're both in bed together, which don't take anything.
Yeah.
Don't read any too much into that.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, there are a number of scenes for me still from this being in December. Mm-hmm. And I usually describe this to folks as, we see so many films, 30 days later, any film that's still in my brain from last month, I've pushed eject. And so it's really hard for me to recount, but this one I had no trouble on a number of scenes that still stuck like glue.
Yeah.
And so to that end, bravo. So I'm saying theater on this one. How about you?
I'm a strong theater. Okay. I think definitely get your butts out of your seats. Go watch this in the theater right away.
Sure.
Watch Annette Bening potentially win an Oscar.
Yeah, yeah. Possibly.
Possibly.
Very, very possible. There's a big film that's out this week, maybe semi-big film.
Kind of. I mean, it's hard to tell with this one.
M. Night Shyamalan has put together Split. Tell us about this, Sarah.
Split is about three teenage girls who are kidnapped by an adult male named Kevin, played by James McAvoy.
Or is it Barry?
Kevin
Or is it Barry?
Well, Kevin has 23 personalities,
uh-huh.
All of which take control at any given time.
Is this based on a true story?
No. But it could be. There is, side note for just a second.
Sure.
That's what kind of makes Shyamalan's films often somewhat entertaining, is there is that somewhat possible plausibility factor in there. He's taken a little bit of Rod Serling and kind of injected it with his own spin on him. So,
and it's very much a real life film.
Yeah.
Even though, so this is a pulpy B-movie horror premise.
Mm-hmm.
Guy with split personalities, kidnaps three teenagers and tells them a 24th personality is on the way.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the move.
24. Yeah. So
24 people living inside his brain.
Well, 23 right now.
Yeah.
24th is on the way.
Yeah.
And the 24th is going to do some bad things. We'll just leave it at that.
Right.
Cool. That is about as pulpy a B-movie horror premise as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
And what Shyamalan does is he embraces the real life aspects of what this potentially could be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is mainly through the form of both Kevin,
mm-hmm.
his therapist, Dr. Fletcher, played by Betty Buckley, who we don't get a chance to see as much as we should, who is really kind of wonderful in this movie, but also through the main young girl, Casey,
mm-hmm.
Played by the witch standout, Taylor Joy.
Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah.
There is a lot going on in this film that Shyamalan plays very close to the vest. And like a lot of Shyamalan films, there are little flashbacks that are sprinkled throughout the movie, showcasing who Casey is, who Casey was, what she has been dealing with in her own life,
mm-hmm.
showing what Dr. Fletcher has been trying to do, not just for Kevin, but all of her patients that suffer from this particular disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And then also little insights into Kevin and his various personalities.
Mm-hmm.
All of which allows the film to build up to the requisite Shyamalan pull the rug out from underneath you ending.
Twist.
Was the twist?
Well, we can't.
It's not really a twist, though, because in this case, the twist, like, for instance, Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
They're all dead.
Right.
Or, you know, he's dead. You know, they're spoiler alert, right? But in this case, there isn't quite that same whammo upside the head with the baseball bat punch.
Well,
swing away, Meryl. But
there is.
Do you like that? I got two Shyamalan.
That was good. You did right away. I would disagree. I mean,
really good.
So with this story, you're right. There really isn't. I mean, the movie builds to basically a moment of dual honesty mm-hmm. on the part of our two main leads mm-hmm. that allows for the resolution to take place. Mm-hmm. And that is essentially what the main twist is. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of a baseball bat moment at the very end of the movie, which, depending on who you are, mm-hmm. could change your interpretation of the film completely. This is essentially a horror film. Mm-hmm. But because of the last 2 minutes of the movie, mm-hmm. it actually becomes a completely different film.
And okay. it's just taken like 15 years to get there.
But you can't talk about it.
If
you're open to it, it's kind of cool. I mean, when there's the moment that I knew it was about to happen, and Brian Tybel
leans over to you and says, "Is this the score from blankety blank?"
Yeah. Be careful.
Yeah, I haven't spoiled anything
but
yet.
But basically, Brian Tybel looked at one another and just started giggling out loud because we were excited about it. We were happy about it, and we knew what was about to happen. Yeah. But there were other people in the movie who kind of wanted to throw things at the screen when they realized what was happening. So it does change.
Yeah, M. Night has that effect on people.
Yeah. This changes the fundamental nature of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
As much as I liked it, mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's appropriate in the case of this film. Now, this film, James McAvoy,
mm-hmm. does a great job.
This might be the best performance he's ever given.
I mean, it's as haunting as it is entertaining to watch him cycle through all these different personalities on screen.
They're all completely different. Yeah. Yeah. Every single one of them is its own unique individual.
Hedwig is a 9-year-old boy. Then there's Barry, who's the flamboyant extrovert designer. Then there's Dennis. And then there's so-and-so, who's actually diabetic and has to use insulin. I mean, so we get all these different characters.
It's magnificent. Yeah. And I mean, you're terrified of him, mm-hmm. but you're empathetic.
Yeah.
You really do feel for him. And then, again, Anna Taylor-Joy, just... what a remarkable young actress. I mean, she is going to be something. Two fabulous performances in this pulpy little genre film that nobody is going to remember by the time we get anywhere else, you know, closer to the end of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in January right now. Nobody remembers a January film by the end of the year. And I'm not saying the movie itself deserves to be remembered, but these performances do.
Yeah.
These performances are the movie, and they are both terrific.
Yeah, strong front runners. So where do you come in on this? Are you a theater or a rental on this? Because it sounds like you're on the fence of one of these.
No, I mean, I'm a theater. We're not getting into it because we don't really have the time, but I mean, I think the movie's a little overlong, and I think there are times where Shyamalan overplays his hand and dips into the flashbacks a little too much. I mean, we get it. We know what's going on. We don't need as much as he wants to tell us, but he just can't help himself.
Yeah. That was my issue too. There was pacing involved where it's like, come on, you're keep the foot on the neck of the viewer and make them feel this pressure and keep it going.
It's almost 2 hours long, and I think if this had been like 100 minutes, maybe even an hour 45,
trim.
I think it still would have worked just as well.
Yeah.
But I still think it's a theater, especially just for these two performances. How much you're going to like it though is going to depend on
the last 30 seconds.
Really the last 30 seconds, because if you hate those last 30 seconds, you're going to hate this movie.
Sure enough. Yeah. Tim, by the way, I'm a theater on this one as well. Triple X.
Triple X, The Return of Xander Cage. You caught up with
it. This is the most anticipated film since when?
It's it's the number one action movie of the year so far.
The truest words I've heard all day.
There you go.
So this is The Return of Xander Cage. Xander Cage, if you don't remember, played by the one and only Vin Diesel. Stars Vin Diesel, Donnie Yen. I know I'm going to butcher her name. But Deepika Padukone? I'm going to mess it up.
I don't know.
Ruby Rose, Tony Jaa,
Nina DeBrev. Tony Collette.
So we've got a huge cast.
We've got a huge cast.
Huge ensemble.
And it's this. So the story is funny. So it's essentially.
Don't spoil anything.
I'm not going to spoil anything. But Gibbons, played by Samuel Jackson, is killed and its forces.
Spoiler alert!
It's not a spoiler. It's the beginning. It's literally the beginning.
If it's the beginning of the film,
the film opens with this.
As he's
trying to recruit Neymar to be in Triple X. So he's killed, and so Tony Collette's character tries to recruit, tries to get Xander back in the fold in Triple X.
But isn't Xander's dead? I thought Xander died in 2005.
He's alive. He's in Cuba somewhere.
Wow.
So he tried
family.
these guys
wrong
who,
franchise.
Yes.
This group of people led by Donnie Yen break in. They steal this device called Pandora's Box.
Otherwise known as MacGuffin.
Yeah.
The MacGuffin. MacGuffin. Right. Pandora's Box.
They can control satellites, and they're crashing satellites to kill people.
Ooh.
This is literally the plot. And so so Vin Diesel comes back in the fold. Then he finds his ragtag group of people to help him because he can't be with a bunch of soldiers. And they all go on this hunt to try to find this MacGuffin of an device.
That uses satellites as bombs.
Yeah, that's the movie.
How much motorcycle and BMX riding?
There is a motorcycle that has skis to pop out. That he rides on a wave.
Do missiles fly off of this thing?
No.
He skis through a jungle. He skateboards through a whole town.
Sure. Yeah.
What else does he do?
Does he swing from a vine?
No, he might as well.
Might as well, though.
Yeah. He free falls at one point. There's a big free fall scene.
Does he have a squirrel suit?
There's a lot of bullets.
There's a lot of bullets?
There's a shootout at the end where it's got to be about 100 people to get murdered.
Who knows? It turns into a video game.
Oh, it's just people getting shot. Just people showing up and getting shot.
So how's the production on it? I mean, is this well assembled or is this just is this just crap?
Yeah, no. It looks fun.
This movie,
it looks like they were having, you know what? Tony Jaa looks like he's having so much fun.
Everybody in this movie looks like they're having, this is the most fun that I think
everyone's Vin Diesel
looks like he's having in a movie, maybe ever. Vin Diesel looks like he's having, Vin Diesel never looks like he's having the time
more
of his life.
More fun than Chronicles of Riddick?
I like Chronicles of Riddick.
I'm joshing.
They're having a blast.
But they are all having a blast. And what's weird is that it's kind of, this is the dumbest movie I've seen in ages. It is. Yeah. It's
pretty dumb.
It's like a James Bond movie written by 5-year-olds.
There's really no explanation for why some of the characters do the things they do. Like zero.
So like at one point Xander Cage assembles his new team of superstars and he assembles, you know, he's got like his crack driver who will drive through anything, played by the guy that which one is he on Game of Thrones? He's the Hound. So they're played by the Hound from Game of Thrones, and he's got this crack assassin slash sharpshooter who can, you know,
played by Ruby Rose.
Ruby Rose, who can shoot. Do anything, shoot anything, anywhere.
From anywhere.
And then he also brings into the fold a DJ.
A DJ.
Who apparently can, his superpower is he can make people dance.
He's fun
dance.
To be around.
Yeah. It's like his,
doesn't do anything.
He doesn't do
anything.
He makes people dance. That's what he does.
He like chokes a guy with headphones.
He does, yes. At there's one that, point. Yeah.
Well, there's, selling
but
point.
But I mean, but that's the kind of mentality that this movie has.
Yeah.
Almost all of the action sequences, though, they do, and they're really, really well staged.
It's hard, you know, Donnie Yen's done action so well for years, so it's hard to have a movie with him in it and Tony Jaa, who are both just kings at it, and it's just them running around kicking people in the face.
Yeah,
it's hard to miss with that.
The thing with this movie, it's another reminder, along with Rogue One: A Star Wars Story, that Donnie Yen should have been a Hollywood superstar 30 years ago.
Yeah.
The dude owns every scene he's in, and he does stuff in this movie, and he's over 50 now, I think. He does stuff in this movie where you just sit back and go, holy crap, how are you doing that?
Yeah.
He's amazing. He's just a physical freak specimen. Tony Jaa, on the other hand, who is also a physical freak specimen, who looks like he's having a blast, they don't give him anything to do. It's
got like
so
one
unfortunate.
Or two
yeah.
It's like you've got this amazing martial art acrobat who can do anything, and they just it's so overstuffed that they just don't have the time.
And we talked about this before the movie. Like they really ruined a great cameo in the TV.
They
spot.
Do. There's
they
a great cameo.
There's a great cameo. This ruined
wonderful
in the TV
moment,
spot.
And they ruin it. And don't watch the television commercials.
Yeah, don't watch.
Oh, I was going to say, can you ruin it for me now? But you're telling me, okay.
No. Don't do it.
The movie's dumb. It's also a hell of a lot of fun. It's better than the 2002 film that you know made this character what it was.
And I really liked Deepika, who plays Serena. She was great. I was like, I would love to see her in another like action film.
Well, and Toni Collette is a hoot. Toni Collette's having a blast.
She's
in this
hamming it up.
She's totally overacting, but she has a couple lines in this movie where you literally laugh out loud. We were talking to a few of our other critic friends, and they want to like. Some of her lines in this movie, they want to use as ringtones for when people call. but they're that funny.
Okay.
The movie's absurd. It's a joke. It's insane. It's dumb. It's probably going to be a hit, and I don't have a problem with that.
So check Brain at door, but then
for sure.
Yeah, no.
Are you going? Are you going theater or are you going light matinee? Are you going Rent? Are you going where do you guys fall in?
I'm gonna say Rent.
I'm gonna say Rent.
But if I'm honest, it's probably if you saw this at the if you went and saw this at a matinee before noon when it's $6-7
Yeah.
I would not tell you not to.
A guilty pleasure watch.
I will say don't watch it in 3D. Watch it in 3D. Whoever did the 3D transfer, it's bad.
Did they show this to you guys in 3D then?
Yes. And
I was so disappointed.
Do not watch it in 3D.
Okay.
But the movie's a lot of fun.
If you rent it, if you spend money to rent the movie, you're gonna feel like you got your money's worth.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it might end up being Vin Diesel with a new team. It really...
Tim, they're
setting that up.
Like a week or two ago, you and I were heading up the escalator and through Pacific Place, and you looked at the XXX poster, and you said, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if we just merged a couple universes here, if we merged XXX and Fast and Furious?
Oh, I'd watch that.
You know, could we just merge these two universes together?
Yeah.
I'd
be all in on that.
I would love to see Vin Diesel's characters from Fast and Furious and XXX fight one another.
Oh, God.
They might not even need to fight one another. They could all be on the same team going after some super.
Oh, that'd be awesome, though.
You bring back all the bad guys from those movies.
Yeah.
It's like the... Yeah.
And there are... they make fun of that. There are a bunch of Avengers jokes in this movie. There's a ton of Avengers jokes.
Tons of Avengers jokes.
All right.
Even from a person that you would expect an Avengers joke from, he delivers an Avengers joke.
Jeremy Renner appears?
No.
Oh, that would have been...
That would have been... That, and it could have happened. Everybody else appears in this movie.
So here's the other question, though, that's kind of hanging over the balance right now, the sort of Damocles over our head. Sarah, you wanted to discuss Oscars, and Oscar nominations are going to be out on the 24th.
Tuesday
24th.
Morning, 5 a.m.
We are three very educated folks in the ways of cinema. We can pretty much gather a semblance of what's going to be in there. And you're saying, no, we should really talk Oscar predictions. I'm going, no, Sarah, I don't want to do this. And Tim's saying, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, I think it's too soon.
But you're saying, no, there really is. What's your argument for us doing this?
Well, I think there's value in it because, it allows us to actually look again back at the best films of last year and sit there and say, hey, this is what's probably going to get nominated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame that some of these other things aren't going to get nominated.
Right.
I do also think it's interesting to talk about what is like in the best picture race.
Uh-huh.
We know that there can be, because of because of the Academy rules, there can be anywhere between 5 and 10 nominees.
Sure. Right.
But to become a nominee, you have to get 5% of the first place votes to actually get nominated for Best Picture,
right.
Which means it's almost impossible to actually get 10 nominees. You're probably only going to end up with somewhere between 7 and 9 nominees.
Right.
And it's fun to kind of think to yourselves, what is going to get left out because of that?
Okay.
But what could also sneak in? I also think this year it's particularly interesting just because of the last couple of years of Oscar so white in the acting categories that we do have a year where there's probably potentially going to be somewhere between 5 and 8 actors of color getting nominated, which is nice.
You have more faith in the Academy than I do.
I know you, and I understand that.
I just don't.
I get that.
Okay,
but I honestly think it's going to happen this year just because of the quality of the films that are being talked about.
Even last year with Strata Compton was a great film that just
fell off the radar.
Well,
great performances, great film, fell off the radar.
Yeah, but when you're talking about that movie as far as the Academy was concerned, there was only one performance that was ever getting talked about.
Okay.
And it would have been nice for him to get nominated.
Hmm.
But, that was really the only reality there. It was a little bit of a surprise when you look at some of the precursors to the Oscars.
Okay.
That the only nomination that movie got last year was for screenplay.
Right.
It did feel like it had a chance to get nominated for Best Picture, and it was a little disappointing that it didn't happen.
Okay. So we're looking at...
But this year, you can't tell me Moonlight is not going to get nominated for Best Picture.
Maybe it does. I hope so.
I absolutely think Moonlight will. But you were saying on the way in that you think La La Land's going to be a runaway train as far as nominations are concerned.
Oh, for sure.
La La Land's going to get somewhere between 10 and 14. It could tie the record at 14, but it's going to get at least 10, maybe more than that.
Here's the big question that's kind of looming over my head. We're looking at the black eye of Oscar So White a year ago, and you were, in fact, illustrating, it was actually 2 years in a row. It was
2 years.
But it was really brought to light last year.
Sure.
La La Land is about as white bread and as white boy as you can get.
Sure.
And you get a runaway train like that going up against the runaway train known as Moonlight from Seattle Film Critics Society, also Golden Globes.
But La La Land Golden Globes, La La Land set the record for the most Golden Globe wins of any movie in history. It won seven awards.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's a great film. Don't get me wrong. You have to remember how the Academy thinks.
Right.
La La Land is a movie about Hollywood.
And, right.
And they love that. It's a good movie about Hollywood, which they love that. So, you know, not even nominations that and wins are two different things.
It's not just they love it. I think La La Land is a film that's easy to digest, right, versus something like Moonlight or Hacksaw Ridge that's, you know, got some tough stuff in it. How, like, what do you hate about La La Land that would make you not want to like the movie?
There's a lot of people that actually have some stuff.
You a few things that I didn't like about La La Land. Caught up with it last night. Not real thrilled about the singing that Gosling is doing. Not real thrilled about the singing that Emma Stone is doing.
Okay.
I think they're both
fair.
They can carry a tune, but they don't give either one. Well, Emma is only given one opportunity in the entire film to actually really belt it out.
Which
and,
she does.
And she does, and she does it well, but it's only one time.
But that's not the point of the movie.
But the point
it's also
is...
also not the nature of the musical.
But it is the point of all of those films that we grew up watching, all of those films back in the day when they had studio musicians and studio artists singing those songs, they were doing it, and they were doing it well, and they could belt it out.
But not in the style of this film. This film is in the French style as far as Umbrellas of Cherbourg and those kind of movies.
But I see what you're saying. Like, what's the point of having a musical with the female lead if you don't let her sing?
If you can't let them sing. And then to that point, our producer Sprints was a professional dancer.
Sure.
She's watching it going, the dancing is fair, but the choreography is great. However, comma, you have two non-dancers doing these things and they're supposed to be knocking it out of the park. And they're not really knocking it out of the park.
To be knocking it out of the park.
But they are. If this is what this film is supposed to be playing homage to, they're supposed to be. I want an honest to God triple threat doing this.
No.
I think Gosling and Emma Stone are both well cast. But we had the discussion last night. We're saying, I wonder who else. Who are the seconds? Who are the other people that were up for consideration of those parts? And were they stronger triple threats than the two that we saw?
Well, they weren't. I mean, you got to remember with Emma Stone, she actually wasn't the first choice.
Well, who was then?
Emma Watson.
Really?
Yeah, and if you listen,
so you had to be named Emma to get in the movie.
I don't know, but if you listen to her singing in the Beauty and the Beast trailer, it's exactly the same kind of thing. So you have to remember what Chazelle is going for. We weren't supposed to have a conversation about La La Land, but you have to remember what it is that Chazelle is going for here. Chazelle is going for a different kind of Hollywood musical. He's going for the latter years of the Hollywood musical. Mm-hmm. He's going for sort of the My Fair Lady-ish kind of Hollywood musical. He's going for the Umbrellas of Cherbourg. He's going for that kind of movie. He wants real people in these magical, mystical situations. He doesn't need Gene Kelly. That's not what he's going for. He wants you to recollect on the color and the vibrancy of stuff like Singing in the Rain and The Bad Wagon.
And that he achieves in spades.
But he wants the realism of something like Umbrellas of Cherbourg. And if you look, and I keep going back to that movie, but that's the movie that this is most like.
Yeah.
If you go back to that Demi masterpiece, you know, Catherine Deneuve is not the best singer in the world. That's why Gene Kelly sort of pops up in a couple little roles. You know, you look at this movie, that's why you have John Legend show up.
Yeah.
I mean,
necessary.
But that's why you do it, because you have that moment where the true superstar shows up and delivers that moment and then allows the realness of everything, the authenticity of everything else to sort of surround that sort of moment of artifice.
Okay.
I really don't care what a director's trying to capture. To me, it's like, does it work?
And I think to most people it does. I mean, if we're having the Oscar conversation, though, to Oscar voters, it does.
Yeah. All right.
Which got us completely off topic.
It didn't. I got one more question for you on this, though, which is...
Sure.
Okay, so, I mean, we have lightly talked about predictions without talking directly about predictions, but you were saying that you think there are going to be some real surprises coming up.
There are going to be some real surprises.
What is surprising to you? I mean, you said at one point to me earlier that you're thinking there are 16 possible women or performances that could be Best Actress.
If you look at the 16. Best...
16. But I can't even remember 16 performances.
If you look at the Best Actress field this year, you've got...
Six, barely in my head.
If you've got the people... people that they have been talking about that could potentially get nominated. You've got Annette Bening, Sasha Lane, Amy Adams, Rebecca Hall, Isabelle Huppert, Hailee Steinfeld, Emily Blunt, Meryl Streep, Taraji P. Henson, Sally Field, Natalie Portman, Kate Beckinsale, Sandra Hüller, Tika Sumpter, Amy Adams, Taraji P. Henson, Natalie Portman, Emma Stone.
Half of these names,
Jessica
Sarah.
Chastain.
Half of them. No way. No chance.
No,
they're
not a chance.
All in the conversation.
There's the conversation is never that big.
It is that big this year. This year it is that big.
That's like the MVP conversation in sports, right?
Yeah.
There's like eight people be MVP. No, there's like three. Right. There's three every year.
The general consensus.
It's never eight or nine.
The general
three.
Consensus is that it's going to be Emma Stone, Natalie Portman, Annette Bening, Isabelle Huppert, and then one other person, probably Amy Adams.
I didn't see.
And I will. And I will tell you that at least two of those women are not going to get nominated.
Okay.
And I would say the only real lock in the category is Emma Stone. Emma Stone probably will not win. Okay. But she, right. because of the movie, she is the only lock to get nominated. Anything could happen with those other four spots. You know, we had Kathy.
Not anything.
We had Kathy Fennessy.
Anything's not going to happen.
We had Kathy Fennessy on the show a few weeks ago who said it was 99% certain that Isabelle Huppert was going to get nominated for Best Actress. I actually think there's a really good shot, even though she's won more pre-Oscar awards than anyone else, because of the nature of that film, how difficult it is to watch, and because Elle did not make the foreign film shortlist, I think there's a very real possibility she does not get nominated, that somebody else sneaks in there. And when you look at something like, say, Hidden Figures, which comes out of nowhere and becomes this colossal success, at the exact same moment that Oscar voters receive their ballots in the mail and are actually voting, they look at that and suddenly that screener goes to the top of their pile and they watch it right away. And Taraji P. Henson is suddenly in their heads. She's there. They're staring at her because of all of the buzz.
I don't think she gets nominated.
I don't think she does either, but I'm just saying that there is going to be a surprise like that. Everybody wants to say that the big surprise is going to be Deadpool getting nominated for Best Picture. I actually think that's really unlikely, only because I don't see how it gets 5% of first place votes.
Yeah.
What 5% puts that at first place?
If Adam's voting, it does.
I know.
There's that.
But what could happen, and people, you have to remember the nature of the voting body of the Academy, even though they're trying to increase diversity.
Yeah.
What could happen is a movie that we're not talking about, something like, say, Florence Foster Jenkins.
Yeah.
That could get 5% when you realize that the majority of the voting body is still 90% white and 70% over the age of 60.
I was going to say, 90% old.
And,
nobody
is talking about that, but Florence Foster Jenkins could very easily become a Best Picture nominee.
Okay. So to that end, let's put a stamp on it. We got to bring this one into the barn. We've got a couple films that we've just talked about, and we've lightly talked about Oscar predictions without talking Oscar predictions. How about Live by Night? We had two skips and one rental from the Squabblers. Patriots Day, getting two rental recommendations, one skip recommendation. 20th Century Women, two strong theater recommendations. Split, two theater recommendations. And Triple X, getting the rental recommendation, so the double rental on that factor.
But strong rental. Weird.
Are you doing any other projects right now, Sarah?
Not at the moment. Just working on Oscar predictions. That's about it.
Yeah, Tim. How about yourself?
No special projects. Just it's January, February season. So
it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
There it goes. And there go us. Episode 49, Cinema Squabble. Thank you much for joining us. If you've got the chance, swing on over to iTunes, give us the thumbs up, the likes, and give us all the stars, all the points, all the wins. And thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer this evening.